August 28th will be the 50th anniversary of the 1963 March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. This march of 250,000 plus people of all races was pretty much unprecedented at that time and marked the 100-year anniversary of President Abraham Lincoln's signing of the Proclamation of Emancipation in 1863. This march culminated with a demonstration at the Lincoln Memorial and is now probably best known for a then 32-year-old minister of a small black congregation, Martin Luther King's famous speech, I Have a Dream. And tonight on the Roadhouse, we're happy to have Professor Catherine Squires, who is an associate professor, communication studies at the University of Minnesota. Professor Squires has studied and written about African American social movements and media coverage of civil rights movements. In July, she participated in the panel discussion, Media Memory and the March on Washington, which was convened by the Newseum Institute in Washington, D.C. Professor Squires, welcome to the Roadhouse.
Can you hear me now?
Now we got you aboard. Thank you. Professor Squires, you were listening to my introduction. What other elements besides those I covered in the intro came together to help set the stage for this pretty much amazing event back in the time?
Well, it's really interesting, especially when I hear some of my students talk about the march. What they are most familiar with is just a few lines of Martin Luther King's speech that day. But actually, this march, a lot of people thought when they were organizing it, they weren't sure how many people were going to show up and if enough were going to show up at all for it to matter. They had been organizing the march for almost over a year, and it was coming together, and they were hearing that people were going to be there. And as soon as the report started coming that people were going to be on buses and coming on trains and coming in cars, a lot of the authorities in Washington, D.C. were actually expecting violence. They were expecting trouble. So we have to remember that this was a very volatile time in American history, and that many of the civil rights demonstrations were met with violence, especially in the South, and Washington, D.C. is in the South, we have to remember. And so it's got this amazing resonance, I think, with us because it did turn out to be so massive and so peaceful. And so that's the lingering feeling that most people get about the day, is this peacefulness and this coming together. But if you look at the speeches that were given and you look at why people were coming together, they were talking about economic justice, they were talking about social justice, and they were talking about, you know, really pushing forward in the country to make equality a reality.
Now we just think about, of course, the one famous speech that Martin Luther King is very well known by, but there were other very well-known and perhaps more well-known civil rights people there who gave speeches as well, and they're pretty much forgotten. Were there highlights that you've looked at that we should know more about?
Well, I think one person that really has to stand out is A. Philip Randolph, who had been a civil rights and labor rights organizer for a very long time. He was the head of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, which was one of the most important unions for African-American men, of course, because being a sleeping car porter on the trains was one of the few well-paying jobs that African-American men could get in the 20s and the 30s and 40s. So A. Philip Randolph had actually planned a march on Washington during World War II to protest the fact that so many of the jobs that had been created to help the war effort were segregated. And so he planned a march on Washington back then, and asked him to not have the march because he thought it would be such a show of dissent during the war at a time when they wanted the world to see the country as together. And A. Philip Randolph used that fear of this image of America not coming together to press for reform, and actually Roosevelt signed an executive order desegregating the war industries, and so the march didn't happen. But A. Philip Randolph always wanted that movement, that idea of pressure and tension, to continue and not let up, and so he was part of the organization of this march that actually did come to fruition to put additional pressure on the government to make good on what King famously called the check that had not been cashed. And so A. Philip Randolph spoke directly to issues of economic justice that disproportionately affect African Americans, but the need for unions as well as other institutions to desegregate and to think about building a different kind of economic platform that would truly allow everyone to have a chance.
I understand that John Lewis, who was another of the so-called Big Six, who were the main people involved in organizing the whole event, was only 23, and he had a speech that he had put together that the other folks such as Bayard Rustin and Randolph and maybe others involved there were trying to talk him out of making. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, yes. SNCC was at the forefront of a lot of the sit-ins and a lot of the marches, and they were helping recruit people for the Freedom Rides and all of this. And so they had really suffered a lot of the brutality in the Southern movement and were also very radical. I mean, King was a radical as well, but at this point he wasn't as radicalized as some of the people in the student movement. And John Lewis actually had a line that went something like, if we don't see some progress, we're going to do something like Sherman's March through the South. And so when he made that allusion to the Civil War, a lot of the other Big Six leaders thought that would be seen as too inflammatory, and so they asked him to tone his speech down. And so basically the night before and the morning of the march, he was making changes to his speech, but they weren't sure if he was actually going to make all the changes that they were requesting. And of course, at a live event, he could, of course, ad-lib if he wanted to. He did not ultimately keep some of those lines in that were seen as inflammatory, and perhaps that's why his speech isn't remembered as much as King's speech.
Now, I know for a lot of folks out in our listening audience right now and are too young to really understand the context of the civil rights movement at that time and just what was happening, and even those of us who were there then, would, if we weren't in the South, wouldn't understand totally what was going on there. I know that they interviewed, that a lot of people who were involved in that march have been interviewed this, over the course of this past year. I know one of them, his name was Ken Howard. He was a student at Howard University at the time, said quite simply, you know, it's difficult these days to understand what it was like to suddenly have a ray of light in the dark. And that's really what it was like to him. How do you think others thought at that time?
Well, I think that, you know, we're lucky that we have a wealth of some of these personal reflections from people in the movement and people who were active in the movement. And I think probably the closest that maybe some of us who weren't alive at that time can come to is maybe thinking about these recent incidents of cases of shootings or police brutality that many young people have been protesting in places like Oakland, California, and in Florida, or the Dreamers movement, where the young people who were brought here by their parents, undocumented, but grew up in this country, who are risking their education, risking their livelihoods to come out and demonstrate about what they see as a grave injustice in terms of judging them on these anti-immigration laws that would hold them responsible for things their parents did when they were babies or toddlers. And so I think the urgency of these new student-led movements, the Dreamers, the folks who are sitting in at the Florida governor's office in the wake of the shooting of Trayvon Martin and the verdict that was given in the trial after that, I think that heightens our awareness of the tenuousness that people feel around their own personal freedom. You know, the students who are out as undocumented, the Dreamers who are pushing for the Dream Act to be passed any moment. They could be deported. They could be arrested. You know, they would not be in control of their own bodies and space. Some of them have been arrested since they've come out and been, be part, become part of that movement. You know, those students who have been sitting in at the governor's office, you know, they're under threat of being arrested for disorderly conduct and other sorts of things. And so I think there are, in places around the country, we're seeing some of that heightened social activism, and maybe you could also cite Occupy, the Occupy movement, at least for a brief moment in its most public kinds of formations in New York and other cities. You are seeing people's sense of urgency that we need a change and that their lives are precarious. Thought they would have to just to do basic things like walk down the street without having to be stopped and frisked by a policeman, be humiliated. So I think, you know, for some people, they can't imagine what it was like to be living in this moment when there were mass demonstrations, because we're starting to see that kind of action happening around these issues of immigration justice and justice around issues of police stop and frisk and these stand your ground laws. So I'm hoping that this generation that's really kicking in with these kinds of protest movements are going to help the rest of us remember why a vibrant democracy needs this kind of agitation.
And I also would mention for those of you who probably never even think about this, but at that time there were blacks could not go into white bathrooms. They could not go into white restaurants. They could not attend universities unless they're black colleges. And there were just so many things that we don't even, they've left our memories.
Yeah, I mean, you couldn't look a white person in the eye. You couldn't address them directly unless they directed you first in many places in the South. We have to remember that young Emmett Till was killed for allegedly whistling at a white woman, or maybe just looking at her the wrong way, when he was visiting the South from Chicago, and he was brutally murdered, and his murderers were hailed as heroes and sold their story after they were judged not guilty. So we have to remember that life was hard, and you could have your life taken away from you for some imagined slight at any moment in time, and know that the people who did it would get away with it. So it was a very, very violent existence, very precarious.
We're speaking with Professor Catherine Squires, who is the Associate Professor of Communication Studies at the University of Minnesota. We're talking about the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington in August 28th, 1963. Here I'm talking about 1863 and Abraham Lincoln's signing of the proclamation. It's amazing that 100 years went by with relatively little change.
Yeah, I think one thing that we should do more of in our history classes is teach about the period of Reconstruction, because it's a really understudied period in our history in terms of what we learn in junior high and high school and even college. You know, that 100-year span between the proclamation and the March on Washington was a time, like I said, of a very violent and precarious existence for many African Americans. You know, brutal segregation, really no chance to vote except for in small pockets of the North. And all of the energy that was put behind maintaining Jim Crow is just, you know, it's just awesome to think about it in terms of how many laws were passed, how much physical violence was enacted to scare people from even trying to exercise their rights, how many laws were put on the books to keep people from crossing into the wrong territory, whether it be a school or a theater or a grocery store or what have you. And you know, you go back and you look at some state law books, and those those laws haven't been struck. They weren't ever officially taken off. So it's an interesting exercise to go back and look at that 100 years, I think. And at the very beginning of it, of course, there were attempts through institutions like the Freedmen's Bureau and such to try and equalize things, but those things were dismantled fairly quickly in the South and elsewhere.
How is this event and Martin Luther King's famous speech, which is famous now, how is it presented at the time in the media?
Well, at the time, A. Philip Randolph was considered one of the major figures alongside King. And we also have to remember that at the beginning of the creation of this idea, as Bayard Rustin, whose name does not get spoken as often as it should, was coordinating the march, the Southern Christian leadership folks weren't sure if they were going to affiliate with the march, and SNCC wasn't sure if they were going to affiliate with the march. And so all of the different groups that ended up being the backbone of the march, the people who represented the Big Six, it took some time for everybody to smooth those things out. And so when there was this pre-publicity for the march, when the newspapers were covering it, at least in the white newspapers, because we have to remember that most newspaper staffs were strictly segregated as well, a lot of the original reporting was questioning whether or not it was wise to have a march, whether there was going to be violence, whether there were going to be troublemakers. Because again, you know, if you think about the sit-ins and the marches and the boycotts that had happened previously, most of these things were met with white violence. So there was a lot of talk about whether or not the event would be peaceful. In the black press, a lot of the talk was about helping people understand how they would get resources to get there, where they could stay, and reinforcing what lots of the organizers were trying to get through to the people, which was, you know, we want this to be peaceful. So it was almost like two different worlds talking about the same event. And so King's speech, it wasn't until after he gave it that a few newspapers, one of my graduate students, Megan Manning, is actually writing her dissertation on this right now, a few newspapers, you know, said, wow, that was a great speech. But they also had excerpts from the speech that Randolph gave and Lewis gave. So it wasn't until afterwards that people started recognizing that speech or saying that speech was really the highlight of the day. And so that's come in successive years. So people recognized it as a great speech in the days and weeks afterwards, but it's really since King's death that become such an iconic part of our memory.
We just have a minute or two left, Professor Squires, and I had one more question for you, and that has to do with whether the March on Washington, this particular march and that particular speech, et cetera, were really a pivotal part of passing the Civil Rights Act, which I believe President Kennedy began and Lyndon Johnson actually got passed, or were there other events that happened following that might have been created more pressure?
Well, some historians would say that it's the combination of the March on Washington and the events when the attempts to march at Selma went so wrong at the bridge where John Lewis famously was beaten by the police. And so that march and the violence that it incited was seen as a huge impetus and a big public relations disaster of pressure on the president to move things along. And like you said, you know, after the March on Washington, Kennedy was relieved it was such a success, and he met with members of the Big Six afterwards at the White House. But again, it wasn't until later, after his tragic death and after Johnson came into the presidency and after Selma, that the acts were actually passed. So it took a lot more. And of course, we know the sit-ins and other agitation continued on through this time. So I think back and say, yes, it was that day in August that really made the country start to get behind civil rights. But it was really the accumulation of almost 10 years. So if we think about the Montgomery bus boycott as some of the first of the modern civil rights movement, then it's almost 10 years between then and 1963.
We've been speaking with Professor Catherine Squire. She's Associate Professor of Communication Studies at the University of Minnesota. Professor Squires, I want to thank you so much for giving us your time on a Friday evening. It's an amazing topic to be discussing here again, and it'll be quite a week to hear more about that event. Thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you for having me.